back to The Green Front. I'm your host, Betsy Rosenberg, and thrilled to be bringing you a longtime friend, someone I have admired from up close and afar, because he's always traveling and working very hard to bring companies to the Green Front. Bill Shireman is who I'm talking about. He is the CEO of one of the original early companies directly addressing sustainability in the corporate world. So thanks for joining me, Bill. Great to have you.
Great to be here, Betsy. Thanks.
Let's first start with the bad news, the sad news about what has been going on in Japan the last 3 weeks. I know you've worked closely with at least one, probably more, Japanese-based companies. Wanted to just get your thoughts on the disaster there, you know, environmentally, on a human level, and what your sources in Japan have told you that perhaps our listeners have not heard yet.
Sure, sure. Well, Tachi Kiyuchi is our global chairman, and Peter David Peterson, who run Future 500 and our consulting arm, E-Square, out of Tokyo, have been in regular touch with us. All their families, the 25 staff that we have there, and their families are safe and secure at this point, and they tell us that the Japanese are showing their traditional stoic patience in responding to the tragedy.
Amazing.
But there are behind the scenes, they have been watching what's been happening. They've told us that the numbers that have been killed are much higher than are still being reported in the media, that certainly more than 10,000 just on the east coast of Honshu itself have lost their lives, and they expect...
You're talking about from the earthquake and tsunami?
From the earthquake and tsunami, exactly. Mm-hmm. The biggest concern they have now is the nuclear plant itself.
Right. It's not under control yet. It's not, you know, over by any means. Frightening and long-term impacts. It's not like it's not like an earthquake which lasts a minute or two and then it's over, other than the aftershocks or a tsunami. You know, the water comes in, it goes out, and in this case, tragic proportions and devastation in its wake. But this nuclear thing, it's a little less tangible, a little less visible, and yet, you know, just as frightening, perhaps more so because of that.
Yes, it is, and it's interesting to see that just in the last year we have had disasters that have struck virtually every traditional supply of energy. We had the massive Gulf oil spill. We have had deadly mining tragedies in West Virginia and Chile. We have had water.
And talking about that, the triple hit.
Yes, exactly. And the natural gas fracking, water contamination in New England. Now we've got the nuclear disaster in Japan. This, beyond the public health and safety consequences, has military consequences, economic consequences, and really puts the world's energy future in flux.
Absolutely. The positive might be that at least it is happening all at once and forcing us, I hope, to really look at, you know, our energy sources, the pros, the cons of different types of you know, resources, and really to get serious about having an energy policy, at least in this country. You know, we've been lax there.
Yes, absolutely. And unfortunately, I see no real direction on either the right or the left, either the environmental or the business community, to drive us toward real solutions on this. This is clearly an opportunity. Crisis creates opportunity. But unfortunately, so far, I see very little sensible movement toward solutions.
Why do you think that is? And what would you offer if you were president, Bill? What does Future 500 think we should do? Because I think we need some answers here. And if you don't see them forthcoming from, you know, any corner, you probably have some ideas of your own. Would love to hear them.
Well, we always do, I'd have to say. But we do see that there is a path that most of the players are not following. And primarily, fundamentally, we see three or four things that need to be done. Above all, we need to focus now not so much on energy in its various forms. Every form of energy has its challenges. And as we reach the bottom of the global barrel in each of these categories, we find that those challenges, those costs, begin to rise extraordinarily. And that is true, of course, of nuclear. It's true of oil. It's true of coal, perhaps above all. But it's also true of solar and wind and the other kinds of fuel and energy sources that environmentalists like to point to. So I think the biggest flaw in our approach to energy is that we're focused on energy consumption itself. How do we produce more energy by some form? What we need to talk about now is what we call energy productivity, the amount of value that you get from every unit of energy you use, because we have the capacity for a revolution in energy productivity in the next 50 years. We can literally increase by eightfold the amount of energy supply effectively that we have globally by focusing on getting more from less. And at that scale, the relative costs of fossil fuels versus renewables becomes less and less significant to us. So that's what we need to focus on.
Are you talking about the sources we already know about? Or are you talking about putting a lot more into R&D to find other alternatives?
Well, both of those things, but that's not what I mean by energy productivity. What I mean by energy productivity is all the ways that we can stretch the existing supplies of energy, get more value from them. Democrats call this energy efficiency. Republicans think energy efficiency sounds weak, so they call it innovation. And business tends to call it information and communications technology. But these things are the things that are largely ignored by activists on all sides who seem so over-focused on extracting what little energy they can get from sources that are either beyond their prime or well ahead of their prime.
Hmm. And do you think we're doing enough to conserve energy, or is there still more low-hanging fruit to go after, because waste is a terrible thing?
There is extraordinary low-hanging fruit, and the nice thing about efficiency and innovation is that the more low-hanging fruit you gather, the more low-hanging fruit you find. This is something that Dow and DuPont learned generations ago, that 3M has learned generations ago, that as you look to not just consume more energy, but to find creative ways to eliminate the need for energy, that the profits simply expand. Dow, in its early phases of its pollution prevention effort, realized 30% and 40% returns on investment. After a few years, they thought they would run out, but their return on investment skyrocketed from there to 90, even 100% return on investment from more and more dollars spent in this area. The capacity that information and communications technologies have, microchips, the internet, all of the ways that we communicate and convey information today, the capacity that those technologies have to radically reduce the amount of energy that we need to live a prosperous, good life is hard for us to imagine right now. But we have companies that have no concept that what they're doing is an environmental or a sustainability initiative, but that have the technologies to cut water use in agriculture by 80-90%, to improve the efficiency of transportation and communication by similar amounts. Those technologies are out there, but we are blind to them because we seem to be swimming in them.
Interesting. I'm on your website now, Bill. You have a Future 500 Climate Initiative. Tell us about that.
The Climate Initiative is something that we've been working on rather behind the scenes for the last 2 years. We have felt that while the environmental community has been tremendously successful in the early stages of driving the cap-and-trade bill in the Congress, we were afraid that that bill might not pass. And indeed, it not only didn't pass, but the campaign against it and the way that it was exploited by the opponents has made it absolutely toxic for politicians on the right and the left. So cap-and-trade is dead. What we have been working on is an alternative approach that is supported by the right and the left, thinking people on the right and the left. And that is a simple...
I'm glad you qualified that.
Yeah, unfortunately, you do.
You have to these days.
You do, and I think thought is a good thing. We should do more of it.
But, a mind is a terrible thing to waste. Just as a waste is a terrible thing to waste.
It is. It's worse to waste than energy. So, but the simple solution is to cut taxes on payroll and make up the balance with taxes on carbon. A simple revenue-neutral tax shift. That is something that conservative economists have supported for years. Even Arthur Laffer, the king of supply-side economics under Reagan, supports a tax swap. Greenpeace and Friends of the Earth and the most aggressive environmental groups out there also support a revenue-neutral or almost revenue-neutral price on carbon. This is something that can draw together an extraordinary range of powerful political players. And we think it's time for the environmental community and the business community, the technology community, the major brand companies to stand behind this approach.
What do you think particularly of the fee and dividend approach that's been offered as an alternative to cap and trade?
I think it's a good plan. It's certainly, you know, much closer to, if not revenue neutral. And it doesn't have the tremendous flaws, I think, that the cap-and-trade approach did have. Cap-and-trade is a good concept. It was actually a Republican idea originally, as many have pointed out. And it works with some forms of emissions, but it has deep flaws when you try to apply it to something as diffuse and global as carbon. And so the cap and dividend model is a much stronger one. And if we had started that as the basis of the campaign, we might now have that in law. But some folks made strategic decisions that I think were justifiable at the time, but have not turned out very well for us.
You have some signatories with some big names in the environmental movement. Lester Brown, founder of the Earth Policy Institute. Dr. Jim Hansen, of course, the climatologist with NASA. And Randy Hayes, activist extraordinaire. Is that are those signatories to your climate initiative?
Yes, they are.
Future 500.
They are signatories to Future 500 and our climate initiative, and they are leaders in the effort to pass an approach like this. It's fascinating to see that you have this extraordinary range of supporters from the far left to the far right who like the idea of a tax swap or a cap-and-dividend approach. These are people you don't see in the same room very often. But together, they have the capacity to win in a Congress, even a Congress where the House is dominated by Republicans, even a Congress where the Senate is dominated by Republicans. With that kind of support, we can actually win.
I want to spend the next 10 minutes talking about Future 500, Bill, building relationships that matter, linking corporations and NGOs to advance the triple bottom line is your tagline there on your website at future500.org. You formed this company more than a decade ago, because I remember covering it when I first started way back last century, late 90s. So just give us a little bit of history, what led up to your starting Future 500, how far have you grown, where are you headed? What have been some, you know, successes you're most proud of? What has been perhaps most frustrating, perhaps continuously most frustrating, maybe politics getting in the way of, you know, the planet's health and human being future on the planet, this being our only home. And I know you're a father, so there is that personal investment as well that so many of us have, and yet not enough, you know, parents in this country are activated to do everything they can to make sure that there's a stable climate and abundance of, you know, fresh air, clean food and water supplies for their children and grandchildren, such as what we grew up with.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think, you know, I started out the way many people do in my youth, very concerned about the future of our country, of our planet, and looking for the enemy that was causing our problems. I remember in my very young days, before I was 10, marching in environmental protests organized by my science teacher in school. I remember on my own during the first energy crisis in 1974, walking up and down the long gas lines and gathering signatures to split apart the oil companies. I remember in my high school days writing articles for the local paper and becoming something of a local celebrity by fighting nuclear power and PG&E, who was the chosen evil force at that time. And I remember in college advocating a California bottle bill and fighting for that against what I saw at the time also as the evil opposition, the retailers, the major beverage companies, beer companies, and packagers that were stopping that law. Eventually, I came to realize that while the demon opposition was a nice, powerful metaphor or symbol, that in fact what we were fighting was not an evil enemy. What we were fighting was a systemic flaw that was driving incentives for everybody through the system to undermine the long-term health of the system. And that what we had to do was to get these supposed enemies together to look not at each other as the enemy, but to look at the problem in the system. And so I began to focus on building coalitions around the fundamental solutions. The first one that we did that people like to call attention to is the California bottle bill. We were battling for a traditional Oregon-style nickel deposit on containers. We couldn't get that through the legislature. We couldn't get it on the ballot box. And so we began a kind of carrot and stick campaign where we threatened on the one hand to advance a statewide bottle bill by initiative, but we offered on the other hand to work with our opponents to find a better alternative. And smart people like Bill Coors at Coors Brewing Company, Chuck Collings, the head of the state's retailers, and others took us up on that. And together, we developed California's bottle bill, the CRB system that you see, which has now recycled something like a quarter trillion containers under the state and saved $5 or $10 billion along the way. That was our first big success.
Congratulations.
And since that time, we've been working in many different areas around the world to bring about similar successes on other issues.
And tell us about, you know, what kinds of companies you work with, how many you have on your roster. Over how many years, Bill? When did you actually start Future 500?
We started Future 500 15 years ago. And
that's what I thought.
We have about 80 or 90 companies that are actively involved as partners of Future 500 globally, 40 or 50 in Japan, 20 or 25 here in the States, and a handful in China for our three offices. And with those, we specifically identify areas of common ground between those companies and the activist community, environmental activists, human rights activists, on the left, on the right. We find areas of common ground where they can work together. There are always areas of dispute and conflict, and those we certainly are aware of, and we don't diminish the importance of those. But we find that every company can be heroic in one or more areas, and we find those areas, and we help the companies identify how they can work together with the activists to make their heroism real.
And you were one of the first ones that I recall use the term, which is now very familiar, the triple bottom line. So kudos to you for seeing that that is really key. And another recollection I have of your great work was you bring together stakeholders. And in my other hat as founder of the Don't Be Fueled Mothers for Clean and Safe Vehicles campaign back in 2003, launched in the wake of 9/11, we mothers from Marin County initially felt that we should be not wasting fuel, you know, burning more oil unnecessarily so we could, you know, have soldiers dying in Iraq. So for health reasons, safety reasons, geopolitical reasons, we started this grassroots campaign. And you were nice enough to bring us together, my co-founder Lynn Fuller and I, to meet with General Motors' Dave Bartmus. He's still with the company, of course, and he was interested in hearing what we moms thought about GM's hydrogen program at that point. They were talking to school kids about that, and we said, well, what else are you doing? What about investing in hybrid vehicles and that kind of technology? And he was heavy on the hydrogen future, but not so much on the hybrid. And we told him that we thought that, you know, that would be a good thing to invest in the technology that's, you know, here right now, and that by the time our children, I said this, I remember, get to the age where they're driving, and I now have a 16-year-old daughter, either hydrogen will be part of, you know, our fuel future and be fueling cars or not. But in the meantime, you know, to kind of get on the technology that's available that's much cleaner. And he told me later, years later, that that conversation did make a difference, and that he went back to the head of GM. I ran into him. It just so happened at a green conference in L.A. the same week that, you know, the car executives were in Detroit, you know, testifying, actually from Detroit. They took their private jet, we all remember that, to testify on Capitol Hill about, you know, why they're going bankrupt and why they're not investing in more fuel-efficient vehicles. That was part of the conversation. So I bumped into him at this Hollywood Goes Green conference. I said, Dave, I have to ask you, in light of what's going on today, you know, did you ever tell your superiors, you know, what we in California were asking for? And he said, actually, I did. I said, what did they say? He said, Dave, you've been drinking the Kool-Aid, been drinking the California water out there. So they poo-pooed it at the time back in 2003 or 2004, whenever you brought us together, and lived to regret it, I'm sure. But that was a little bit of congratulations, I guess, opportunity to congratulate you for your foresight, and also for we moms. You know, they should have listened to we mothers from Marin County when we said we do want more fuel-efficient, family-friendly vehicles, and we will buy them if you build them.
That's absolutely true, and I think we need to turn that around too, because there are so many times that we fail to listen ourselves to the opportunities that are presented to us from the business community. I remember, you know, I think it was a half generation ago, when the heads of the three major, at that time, U.S. automakers, all indicated that they would support a price on carbon, a carbon tax shift at that time. So, you know, 10, 15 years ago that they said that they would do that. And the environmental community uniformly fell into the kind of mythology that anything good that a company might say they would support must have a solely cynical reasoning behind it. They can't be serious about that, because it doesn't make intuitive sense that they would support that. And they missed an historic opportunity to establish a price on carbon. Similarly, under the Clinton administration, and this is a very close loss, President Clinton proposed a BTU tax at that time that would have been imposed, of course, on all forms of energy, very similar to a carbon tax, to close the deficit.
We're running out of time, Bill.
And they were on the verge of getting API, the major petroleum group, to support it when they sold out to the coal sector, and we lost that opportunity. So we leave so many opportunities on the table.
Well, this is a critical moment in our, you know, we're at the energy crossroads, and let's hope we don't miss an opportunity. I can't think of a better one to really take a hard look, a bipartisan, united look at where we get our energy, where we're going to continue to get America's energy needs met. Thank you so much for your great work, Bill Sharman at the Future 500. Thanks for joining us, and we wish you well. And
thank you
for joining us on the Green Front today, my listeners. If you'd like to hear this entire program, I encourage you to check out the archives posted on the Green Front. That's thegreenfront.com the day after the show. And thank you to the Progressive Radio Network for carrying us live. See you next week. In the meantime, have a great green, safe week.